Now, yesterday we talked about the world crisis in education. Ended up talking about that chart, and that isn't what I want to talk about today, but I just thought that as a background, we pointed out that there are a lot of different variables that are impinging on education and causing it a lot of troubles and vice versa. What I'd like to talk about today is the use of new non-traditional techniques in education in terms of helping to solve some of the educational problems and also other kinds of problems, like we were just talking about. When you get into this kind of thing, you get into a lot of other things. Education, of course, is not an objective unto itself. It's an objective to teach people to do other things that will help them solve problems, etc. So it's going to be kind of an open session. I have a few basic concepts and ideas I'd like to show you again and tell you some of the things we're doing and show you some experiences that we've had, and then open it up for questions. What I'd like to do today, two things before I start, is one, to tell you a little bit about my background. You helped me out a lot by showing that my background is not computers, and my interest really is not in computers per se, it's more in solving problems. And I've spent most of my life in research, about 10 years in research for the government, and then the last 8 years working on looking for solutions to social problems, and a lot of it in employment. My background is pretty much looking at how to help people find their way through the problems that they have to become productively employed. And we've had some very nice successes and some very spectacular failures, but we've learned a lot of principles along the way. And one of the things that my company does in its social responsibility program, rather than donating its money to the symphony and to the arts and things like that, which it does a little bit of, but not very much, it takes its money and invests it in programs that will help people find their way into society or improve their productivity or their quality of life. And we do a wide range of things, and they all tend to fit together. They're beginning to fit together. Like, we have a project on the Rosebud Indian Reservation in South Dakota. That's one example, where we discovered that after the Vietnam War, they lost all of their medical facilities, and they had a terrible high incidence of three or four different kinds of childhood diseases. And so we decided to apply whatever resources we have to their problem and let them solve the problem, but we'd provide them with the resources. And that's been very successful. The Indians themselves have put together an organization which has literally wiped out those four childhood diseases, including smallpox and some other things. The most important and critical thing, there were two things. One was an organizational thing to try to discover who really ran the Indian tribe, and we found out it was the women, not the men. But the other thing was management education. We discovered that the Indians had never learned how to manage a medical organization or any kind. And in order to set up their own business, which they wanted to do, we provided them with management education, and it's very successful, all except for the politics. And that's something else, again, that we don't know too much about. So education fits into everything. It runs across about 50 different projects we have like that. Let me show you a few things, though, about what's been going on. First of all, a phrase that I like very much. This is Alvin Toffler from Future Shock, and I really like this because this is what's happening to us in everything. No matter where you are, you're running into this dizzying disorientation that's caused by the premature arrival of the future today. And that's just a fantastic idea because that's hitting us all. I think that's one of the major problems in education, and it is in everything else. We don't know what to do with all this stuff that's here today. Oh, incidentally, I'd like to talk about just what's here today, too, for a while, rather than get off into the future. I'll do that toward the end. But I'd like to talk about just what's available today and show you how far out it already is and how difficult it is to deal with. And so let's take a look at some of the ideas that people have had. These are quotes from studies that have been done by people like the National Science Foundation and others that are taking a serious look. Some of them, I think, come from the Department of Defense. Most people agree that are working with systems like computers that they are the most probable vehicle to both enhance the quality and breadth of education while reducing the costs. There's a lot of argument about reducing the cost. And now I'm talking about just standard education, nothing esoteric, math, science, English, all of the kinds of courses that are basic, the reading and literacy, management courses, those things that are terribly expensive to give. and that are growing in costs, growing so fast that that you can hardly deliver them. In fact, I ran the education program within our company, and I think we have something like 10,000 managers, and I was only able to provide training to about 1,000 of them with the budget that I had. I think my budget was like $500,000 or maybe two. I forget what it was, but it was something. Let's take five. This was 3 years ago. I implemented just non-traditional techniques and some computer-based education, and within 4 years, we have caught up with all the backlog of training and are now able to provide 100% of all the training needs for about $1 million. So we just doubled our costs and were able to serve 10 times as many people, and to do it even better. And the research is coming back now, and we're evaluating it very carefully. It's coming back. We're actually doing it better. I'll show you some of the reasons why. They do give us the capability to extend our intellects and to cope efficiently with the information overload. That's a topic I want to talk about next week, information overload and the whole business of expanding knowledge. I think I mentioned yesterday I just attended a National Science Foundation conference where they talked about the use of information and knowledge in the year between now and the year 2000. And that is really either a serious challenge or a serious problem. And we have to work with systems that will help us do that. If we do it right, it's going to be very exciting. If we do it wrong, it'll be, I think, somewhat disastrous. Okay, here's the Carnegie Commission. Last year I gave a session on their whole report of the Carnegie Commission looking at education. They called it the fourth revolution in education. There have been four major revolutions. One was when they decided that the elderly should pass on wisdom to the younger people, and they separated younger people out as a class unto themselves to be taught. That was a big deal. That was thousands of years ago. And then the next really big thing in education took a long time, but it was the printing press. That was a revelation because it passed out information very quickly. And then the third one was the invention of mass production of education, the public school in the United States principally, and I guess in Europe. And then finally, the fourth revolution is the computer. This was done about 1970. All the good stuff that's really available and has a lot of background is still coming out in based on the 70s stuff. But they came up with the fact that it's a matter of time before computers are implemented, not whether or not they will. It's rather a slow process, just like closed-circuit TV and all the kinds of gadgets that have come out. They aren't really taking hold. Only about 5% of all the education that takes place in the United States takes place outside the traditional mode. And that's not very good for considering the things that those things could really do. So they have been set aside and rejected because of costs and other things. The Carnegie Commission believes that because of all the economic consequences we talked about yesterday, that we will eventually be using these things. I think the thing that will get us into them is that they're so exciting to use, which I hope to be able to pass on to you this morning. Okay, and then finally, they said, I forgot to tell you what they said. This is an important point. It's a little bit off to the side, but it says that the most significant advances in educational technology are going to be generated by emerging institutions outside of the traditional institutions. And I'll describe one that I'm helping to establish right now. Later on. Finally, the National Science Foundation, which has been studying this for a year and has in fact funded most of the research that we've done on computers, says that they have concluded after about a 5 to 10 year study that where adequate facilities and quality course materials, that's a very important one. As I told you yesterday, that's my job primarily, to provide quality course materials. When they're available, subject matter can be taught more readily and meaningfully and more thoroughly with the aid of a computer. And that's not a light statement, because the guys who ran that study started out thinking that computers were for the birds, and they really were negative until about the last year, I think. They finally got with it. That's a new study, not too old. So I'd like to lay some background concepts regarding uses of non-traditional techniques in education, just to give you a frame of reference. Words like systematized, interactive, these come later, and that's sort of a stair step up as you go from the things that we primarily have today, which are programmed and individualized materials, which really are systematized. It's just taking a systematic look at what you want to teach and make sure that that the objectives are stated and that things work out sequentially, and you can test someone to make sure that they've learned something before they go on into the next sequence, etc. There have been a lot of failures in that area, and there have been a lot of successes. I think primarily that's because of the way it's practiced and the amount of knowledge that people have in doing that. In fact, for the last year, I've been building a course, a very large course, on how to author course materials throughout these systems. Just finished it, and we're now evaluating it, and discovered that hardly anybody in the education profession really knows much about the basic rudiments of course materials. You can get a PhD in education and not have had a course in instructional design. In fact, most people that have PhDs in education have not had any instructional design background. They've had a lot of other things, but nothing about how to actually put materials together, which surprised me. The next step up in the use of non-traditional techniques is the addition of multimedia, which is primarily cassettes and television, audio cassettes, video cassettes. Then finally we come to CAI, which is computer-assisted instruction. And I think most of you have somehow run into that. If you have kids in high school, most everywhere now, someone's got a teletype terminal that is plugged into a system where they can do some things, math and games, and play certain things. All of our kids have been doing that. And some kids get hooked on it, and they become computer nuts, and it's hard to get them to do anything else. We've got a son like that who really just loves that kind of thing. But everybody gets exposed to that, and they're relatively rudimentary devices right now, but they're being upgraded. Computer-managed instruction is some of the things we began to talk about yesterday, where a lot of the management things that are now practiced by the teacher and the system, or are not done at all, are done by the computer to free the teacher up, and that's where the role of the teacher begins to change into hopefully a more positive direction. Self-paced is an important word because it gets into that formula we were talking about. I can't remember if that was in the first session or the one we held afternoon. That formula right now most things are taught in such a way that the material and time are constant. The material is presented for a certain amount of time, and whether or not the student learns it is the variable. Doesn't have to learn it, because when the time's ended, boom, it's done. Self-pacing by using new techniques will allow the student to spend as much time as possible until all the time that's necessary to learn the materials, and that then becomes the constant. The materials also vary in the way that they're presented. Some kids might like to read it. Others might like to see it on a television set. Others might want to play around with a computer and interact. And that's a big science now, which is the best way to present materials. And then competency-based, there are all kinds of words like that, but that means that it's based on the fact that in order to progress from one sequence to another, you have to prove that you've actually learned something, or something like that. Satellites and video discs we'll talk about a little bit later. That's the future. That's kind of the fun stuff. Now here are a few of advantages that are beginning to come out of the research. And the research spotty, I've been reading it all and getting as much as I can, and it's usually not very well done. The best research that I can find is being done in the Department of Defense, but even there it's not too good in certain instances. The University of Illinois, where we have done a large amount of work, has done some good research too. Basically, the advantages of computer-based and non-traditional techniques is that the learning motivation, something about motivation that tends to go up. I have a lot of personal experiences and case studies involved in motivation. For instance, with our own kids. I have a son who doesn't like math, and a lot of kids don't like math. But when they come in and start working on our systems and playing the games that are really math games, they don't see them as math games, and they get into it, and they work hard. In fact, my son is so turned on by the teletype terminals that he's taking computer math now, and we just had a terrible time getting him to do anything in math at all. He was darn near flunking, and now he's getting to be a whiz at that, and in fact, he's taken the whole author training course that will teach him how to author in this system. We have a high school in Baltimore, Maryland, that we began working with 2 years ago, where we picked the worst high school we could find, the highest truancy rate. We have one of our largest companies located in Baltimore, and part of their social responsibility program was this school. They adopted the school. Most of the kids didn't come to school most of the time, so we set up a room full of terminals and and developed a course called, it's a survival course, consumer credit kinds of stuff, teaching kids how to handle money. But we did it with games and simulation. And a peculiar thing happened. Kids started coming to the class, and they wouldn't go to any of the other classes. And one evening, we discovered that the kids were breaking into the schoolhouse in order to get at the terminals, and they had somehow gotten through the code that it takes to get through. They got the instructor's codes, and were coming in after school and breaking into the room and manipulating the terminals and using it. And so it wasn't too long ago, there was a big article in the National Observer said, kids break into school, you know, to get training. There were a couple of these kids that went on and now are in college. They have picked this stuff and started learning math and other things on the terminal. And they were the only kids in their family, you know, as far back as they could go, that ever gone to school. We have a lot of these things now in prisons and in juvenile homes. I find the same thing. My personal feeling, and I've got some research going on to try to figure out what this is that the teacher is an authority figure that turns a lot of delinquently oriented kids off. And the terminal seems to operate just the other way around. It's something that they can manipulate. The student can manipulate the terminal and get it to do things, and it does a lot of fun things that a teacher can't do because they're so busy. But an authority figure, no matter who you are, no matter how good you are, if you're an authority figure, there's not a thing you can do with a kid that's turned off on authority figures. I think that must be one of the most difficult things in teaching. No matter how excellent the teacher is, if the kid doesn't want to listen to you, you've had it. Another advantage is less time, and this I've discovered very, very much in my management education courses. By allowing students to go through and not be held up by classes, or by to devote more time on their own time at home using program text or audio or sometimes video stuff, they tend to get through it very quickly. The Air Force has a classic thing that I've just reviewed again 3 weeks ago in Denver. They've trained 8,000 airmen in 4 different courses over the last 2 years, and have discovered that they've cut the training time by one-third, and they're getting toward 50%. It'll take them 50% less time, and they're learning it better. And to the like Air Force or like business, that's money in the bank, because you don't have to have so many people. It's cut down their recruiting program significantly in those occupations, and now they're expanding it like crazy. Part of that is because you're not held back. If you really know the material, you don't have to sit through a class that you already understand. And the other is that you can spend a lot of your personal time outside of class learning it. In fact, the Air Force experiment at Lowry Air Force Base is completely instructorless. They have some monitors, and where the instructor has then become a manager and an advisor for those problems that cannot be taught through the system. And so so the whole role of the teacher there has changed significantly to the better. One of the things that was important to me is that I never knew whether or not the managers that I sent through very expensive training were learning anything. Because even though we do some post-testing, it didn't work very well, and it was always after the fact. Now I know for sure just exactly what they learned, when they learned it, and if they're having problems, and whether they should go back and relearn something else. You can spot failure immediately, and you don't have to wait for a while. You can go right back in there and start working right away with a student. And here again is where the teacher as a resource comes in, because they can work on the problems individually that people are having along the line. We can go slower if you want to. It's very flexible in terms of updating material. Our materials change quickly because of the constant change in technology, engineering courses particularly, or vocational things like that. And so the updating can be done online. We can, in a computer, you can update just like that. You don't have to reprint a lot of textbooks. It's all done immediately. You can have 500 students accessing the same material, and overnight you can update it, and those 500 students will see something new the next day. And finally, simulation, which I think is, and many studies have proven to be the key to retention, particularly in medical schools where this has been practiced. The ability to actually try something out ahead of time instead of in a real-life situation and make mistakes and fail has really proven to be effective, especially in medicine. There's a simulation I keep trying, which is a disastrous one. It's a simulation where a child comes into a hospital and you're an intern, and it's got some symptoms, and you have to go through all the business of trying to figure out what's wrong. There's a lot of diagnostic things you can do, and then you try to treat it. And I'm trying to figure out what to do. Instead of asking a pediatrician what to do, I've been trying to learn, and I've killed a child 17 times now. And that's really kind of, it's really, the first time was just traumatizing. This thing goes zap up on the screen, comes something and says, what does that say? Well, no, postmortem comes after this one. It says, you know, dead, something like that. You killed this poor child. Patient expired, yes. And then you go back and get a postmortem. Well, by studying the postmortem results, I've been able to discover what I'm doing wrong. But, oh, is it ever time-consuming? And the thing that impresses me is how difficult medicine must have been in the days when they were trying to figure out how to save these kids. Because they had to do the same thing I'm doing, except they had to wait around for them to die and do a postmortem and look at it and say, well, we did that wrong, let's try the next one. And it really impresses me. I've never realized how difficult medicine is before. And even the problem of looking at that child could have, the symptoms are so general that they could have 20 different things wrong. And there's a clock ticking in the corner. And there's a blood pressure and something else going, and they're both going in the wrong direction. Respiration, something else, pulse. And as the clock goes along, those are getting worse. And pretty soon, if you don't do anything, the kid comes in at 11 o'clock, and by 1 o'clock, it's dead if you don't do anything. And but I've learned to do about half the things that I need to know. But it's a long way to go. A lot better to do it that way than on live patients. And one of the nice things, the University of Illinois, they have a veterinary medicine course where they will show the students through simulations all the things they can possibly run into that they would never run into in college, because you just never find examples enough to show all the students that come along. And so by the time a kid gets out of veterinary medicine at the University of Illinois, he's been exposed to all the things he probably will ever run into, which is very rare. And that's also true, I guess, in medicine, that you very seldom are able to see all the things you could possibly run into. But here you get a chance to get down and manipulate it and play with it and try it out and see what you do wrong and come back again. So simulation is a very powerful medium. Okay, let me tell you a little bit about the system. I'll give you some history and then how it works. I'll describe it as best I can. And you can't do that very well. I really wish I had a way of showing it to you. Even slides is better than just trying to talk about it. My wife back there is a good resource, so she gets more excited than I do about it, because she hasn't seen as much of it as I have. Our whole family hasn't been involved in this very much. It's been fun. I came from working on the corrections job into taking over the management education job in our company, and then I was told that we're going to convert from the systems that I had, which were very traditional, classroom teaching, over to this new system. And I said to myself, I don't like that. You know, I don't want to do that. Immediately resisted the idea, because I was very comfortable for me to remain in the role that I was in. I had everything down cold, and it wasn't a very difficult job. And then they dumped this whole transition program that seemed impossible on me. So I went down and looked at the system and began to work with it, and I got so doggone excited that I called up the Commissioner of Corrections and got him over right away and looked at this. And while I'd been working for him, I had noticed that one of the great relationships, the only relationship between juvenile delinquency and anything, was failure in school and dyslexia, learning disabilities. That's the only thing anybody has ever found. And that's a pretty big finding, and they weren't even sure that was a causal relationship, it was just there. And so I said, wouldn't this be fantastic if we could somehow use this device to start figuring out how to solve some of these problems? And he said yes. And so we went out and found a few bucks. I got some money from our company, and he got a few bucks somewhere. And we did all the research into the literature on computer-based education and learning disabilities. And then began to actually try it out. We took a program we were aware of and put it on the computer and tried it out and began to get some success. And are now at the point where we have some HEW money to actually take a standard program that is very popular throughout the United States, and we're programming it, and we're going to test it out and evaluate it and begin working it through the public schools in Minnesota. And now I think in Michigan. And while we were doing that, some other group at the University of Illinois was working in correctional institutions with hardcore types. And they took all the material that had been developed on the Illinois system and put that into a special package for adults. And now they have a year under their belt. We've picked that up. We're putting it into prisons in Minnesota. They're picking ours up. They're going to drop it into stuff in Illinois and Michigan and California, I think. And we don't know what the results are, except that the preliminary stuff looks very, very good. The one thing that's never happened before is that the inmates and the juvenile delinquents that we're dealing with are sitting down and doing something, and they are learning. They are learning. We don't know if that's going to prevent or, you know, keep them from behaving badly or whatever that they were doing before, but at least they're learning something, and that's a start. It's about a three-year study before, and we're into our first year now. But that's how I got into this thing, through two different channels, and began to realize that there was a lot more to it. We began setting up learning centers around the country. That was my next job. And a learning center And this is a way that a lot of things are going to begin to look in the future. A learning center is a room that you come in. It may have four or five different little carrels or little places, cubicles. And inside of it might be a videotape playback unit, or it might be a terminal, or it might be an audio cassette playback unit. Now, the terminal that I'm talking about is one called Plato, which is in its fourth generation. It was developed by the National Science Foundation, University of Illinois, with the National Science Foundation's money and our computers. When they started out, they said they wanted to design a perfect educational system, so they set some very high goals. And after four trials, they've gotten to where they wanted to get, and now they set four more generations of goals, which are really far out, and I think they'll meet them. They had to make a lot of inventions, and some people got very, very wealthy. There was one fellow at the University of Illinois that invented a new kind of panel called a plasma panel that everybody's using for everything. They're using it in banks and all over the place, and he's a millionaire now because of this whole project. But it's a very important device. It's going to become more and more evident as we go along. But the plasma display panel is a panel that's about that square, and it has about 2,000 intersecting points on it, and any one of which can be energized by the terminal to turn on a light. So you can draw anything you want on that screen, any kind of graphic, any kind of letter, backwards, forwards. You can write in any language. You can write in Farsi, which is Persian, backwards and upside down, and big ones, little ones. You can draw pictures. You can make people move. You can animate it. If I were to bring you in and show you this terminal, the first thing my 8-year-old daughter would probably do, she's a good demonstrator, would to show you the sentence building lesson, where on the screen there's a bunch of boxes this way, and down below there's some words. And what you're to do is pick up a word, touch a word, and it comes off on your finger. You put it in a box and it stays in the box. And then you keep making sentences. And if you make the right sentence and you push a button, and you touch the screen where it says read, the computer will read it, and if you did it right, then whatever you wrote will happen on the screen. If you say the man walks to the house, a man will appear and he will walk to the house. If you say the house walked to the man, they don't care. The computer doesn't care what you said, as long as it makes sense and tactically, the house will walk to the man. And kids have a lot of fun with that. Although that's relatively simple-minded, it does demonstrate the touch and touch capability, so you don't have to use a keyboard. And actually, there's an awful lot of programming that can be done by just touching the screen. There's a sound device that we're not using too often yet, but it is. I'm beginning to use it now in quite a few experiments, where instead of just having the thing look at visually, the computer will read that word to you. There's one that I really like to demonstrate, but don't get to do it very often. We did this with some 3, 4, and 5-year-olds. We were down at a hotel somewhere. I was just watching this thing. This is a fun one to do. And some family was out in the lobby, and one of our guys came out and said, "Can we borrow your kids for a minute?" And they said, "Sure." Hauled the kids in, and the parents really didn't know what was going on. There was a whole room full of educators that had never seen this before. So they sat the 3 kids down, and there was one that high, that high, that high, and that high. And the first thing that flashed on the screen was a picture of some animal, and it was called a glumph. And I believe that he begins to talk to the child and tells them about words, and then shows them a word and says what a word is, and then says, if you touch the thing at the beginning of the word, I'll say what the word is. If you touch any one of the letters, I'll tell you what the letter is. And then he says, I'll tell you a story. And every time you want to turn the page, touch the funny face down at the bottom of the corner of the screen. And so the largest kid got up and went up to the terminal and took over and started pushing that thing in the bottom of the screen, and he goes through and tells a story about himself. And they start playing with words and touching letters and get all this really neat feedback. None of these, I don't think any of them could read. Maybe the older one could read a little bit, but the 3-year-old could not. Pretty soon, the second one pushed the other one out of the way, and they had a little hassle over the screen. And then they both made a sort of an adjustment, and they began working it together. And they got halfway into the story, and it was really going well, and they were picking up words, and they were backing it up and touching letters. And I was watching the youngest one, because that one is the one that was really sitting back and wondering what to do, very shy. And finally, this little child squeezed up in between the two of them, and before long, he had shoved the other two out of the way and was running the whole show, and every time someone would try to get in there, he'd holler like mad, and should have used some behavior mod on that kid, I guess. But anyway, he had manipulated his two older friends, older brothers, I think, out of the way and was running the whole thing, and was seemed to be learning like mad. There was a very renowned behavioral theorist sitting in front of me. I don't know what his name was, but he made a statement. He said, that's the first time I've ever really seen behavioral psychology in operation. Those kids are really learning something. And they are. They were really getting into it. If they were doing it themselves, there was no one there telling them what to do. The thing just led them in. And there was no branching or anything yet. That was just the simplest way to operate. Sight, touch, sound. Now, the way this is used depends on how creative the teacher is that writes the course. And the teacher then, of course, gets involved and interacts. And there are a lot of things that this thing can't do that the teacher can do. And many of our people have called it team teaching. The computer does a lot of things it does best, and also a lot of the redundant things that teachers don't like to do that are boring. And, you know, you can sit down and if you want to and use, you know, all the computer systems do this. It's not very popular and it's not working too well, but you can repeat the same thing over and over and over and over again until you drive everybody crazy, except the computer. It doesn't get tired of that. In some cases, that's a very good thing to do, although it's not working out too well in practice. But the main thing is, and we found in our learning disabilities programs, that the team teaching thing is very, very good. We have a series of terminals sitting in a classroom with a big screen that you can throw what's on one screen up on the big screen, and the teachers monitor what's happening and look for people that are hung up and look for people that are doing things very well. And quite and more often than not, they will call out an example of somebody that has been able to overcome a problem and throw it up on the screen and say, everybody, take a look at this. You can do that two ways. You can throw it up on a big screen, or you can have everybody shift to what's called a monitor mode, and you can see on your screen what somebody else is doing on theirs. You can do that two ways. You can throw it up on a big screen, or you can have everybody shift to what's called a monitor mode, and you can see on your screen what somebody else is doing on theirs. There are all kinds of ideas that just keep coming to me as I go through this thing, but the one of the things I did one day here recently, most of this is personal experience, I was giving some demonstrations for a series of families. Went through a Friday night and a Saturday morning, and a different family each time. But both of them had a fifth grade boy. And fifth grade boys, I've learned, don't like math. I guess there are hardly any that do. Because what I usually do is get the families all settled down with a terminal and teach them how to use it, and then I feel because this guy's a little bit younger, I'm gonna get him used to the environment, so I take him off, buy him a Coke, go to the top of the building, look at the airport, talk about things, and find out what he likes, and then bring him back down and turn him on. And the thing I found with both of these boys in a row, that they hated math. They just couldn't stand it. And really had you can just see their hair bristle. So I would show them four or five things to do. And then the last thing I showed them was a math thing that was a racing game. It was a speedway kind of game where you have two race cars. And you can pick one for yourself, which is a real sleek car, and one for somebody else, your opponent, which is a junky looking thing. And then you go through a practice round. And you can pick how complicated you want it to be, just simple addition, multiplication, or you can go all the way down to a lot of division and other things like that. Well, they always pick the simple one, and they pick the sleek car, and then they go through a practice round, and then that becomes their opponent's time. And then they have to go through it again and work against themselves. And what they see is a racetrack and cars sitting here, and when the race starts, you get a problem. It may say 2 times 3, and you have to put the answer. And then 3 times 4. And if they make a mistake, the thing will stop and will say, that didn't work. And if they can't get it, it'll show them how to get it, and then they go on. Next time through, that problem will come back in again. They're very sneaky, they sneak it back in. And if you get it right, everything, you know, the bells go off, whistles ring, everything. You really get a lot of rewards. But anyway, whoever wins the race, there's a guy standing there with a flag and all this kind of stuff. He's waving. And for some reason or another, I get bored after the first time around. The first night, I came back, and I had shown this kid how to play tic-tac-toe and Star Trek and some other really exciting things. And I came back in 15 minutes, and he was playing this math speedway game. And I said, well, I did something wrong. I guess I didn't explain to him these other games well enough. So I sat down with him and showed him the other games and said, why don't you try Star Trek? That's really exciting. You can go out and shoot the Klingons and do all this stuff. And so, sure enough, he started playing that, and I felt good and left. Came back in a half an hour, he's back playing speedway. And I said, there's something going on here that I don't understand. And that's where I began to get some insight, something going on in terms of the motivational aspect of this thing for a kid who, and the next day the same thing happened. I tried the same thing out and the same darn thing happened. And every fifth grader or sixth grader I get, I try that out on, and it never fails. They hate math. After it's all over, we walk out and I say some things and talk and say, how do you like math? I hate it, you know, still hates it, but he's been playing for 2 hours a math game and learning very well. So there's something about the gaming thing. And there's something about the individualization. When you're doing it, you're all by yourself. You can do it with others, but that thing's interacting directly with you. And as we get more sophisticated in how teachers program these things, we learn more and more about how to turn people on. Now, that's really getting to be an art. And one of my biggest jobs is trying to find people that are terribly creative, and there are a lot of them around. And I think that's where a lot of teachers are going to end up in the next few years, is in authoring programs on these new systems and then testing them out in the classroom. I can't think of anything that would be more fun. And that's really going to be needed, because the demand for these programs is going to grow in the developing nations. In the United States, I don't see the demand growing very rapidly in the secondary and elementary schools, because the money's not there and there's too much resistance to change. But in the other countries, as I said yesterday, the demand for teachers is so great that it would take two generations, really, of training of all the teachers they could find to get to meet the need today, and they can't wait. And they've already realized that, and they have a less complicated political system than we have, and so they're beginning to implement these things. Iran, for instance, has just decided to buy one of these computers. I didn't tell you some of the other characteristics of it, by the way. It's very large. They can handle, I think the University of Illinois has, what, 800-some terminals simultaneously? I mean, they on there, don't they, Tom? Do you know that? They have 800, and theoretically, the systems we have now can handle up to about 1,000, although they've never tried it, without really degrading it too much. And degradation means mostly response time. If you do something with that terminal, it usually responds within a few seconds, unless it's going off and picking up something and bringing it back to the terminal. The terminal is, in a sense, a little mini computer that can store things. But usually, if you touch a screen, boom, it's right back at you before it's late, before you even know about it. Russia just purchased one of our systems, and they're going to have a 500 terminal system if we can get the export license all cleared up. And they're beginning to expand their systems because they realize the importance of being able to spread a good instructor's capabilities across large numbers of people. And they're also then assured that people are learning things. And that's two of the things that the Russians are really interested in. They're interested in making sure that people really do learn what they should learn out of something like mathematics and science and things like that. But they're also interested in spreading things to a lot of people. Most countries are not like the United States. We have the capability of, at least we feel we are, getting to a lot of people. We're really not, but we think we are. But most of the nations like Venezuela and Iran, those kinds of countries, are not getting to very many people, and their national goals are to get basic education to everybody right now, within the next 5 years. And as I said yesterday, if they don't, they're going to get kicked out of office and somebody else will do it for them anyway. So they're right into all of this stuff and moving very rapidly. There is a scenario that I think will probably happen in that the developing nations that are really savvy and have a lot of money, like Iran, Venezuela, Russia, even China, who are now negotiating with us, will have education systems far superior to ours within 10 years. because we're going to be so slow in getting going, then we're going to have to turn around and bring those kinds of techniques back here. They're going to do a lot of the experimenting. In fact, most of the research that I'm going to be doing is either funded by the Department of Defense, which is not moving much faster than anyone else, but most of it's by the World Bank through underdeveloped nations, who are really trying to figure out which part of all of these things works best. Nobody really knows if computer-assisted instruction is any better than programmed, is any better than multimedia. A lot of people have theories, but I can't find any good research that tells which is better than others. One of your friends has, though, I think. That's why I want to come out here to Washington sometime, because that's one of the keys to this whole thing. What works best in what situation? The future. I mean, it's getting kind of late, and I want to give you some chance for some questions, but the future of what's happening is really going to be exciting, and here's where it gets controversial and kind of scary. First of all, costs. Everybody always says stuff costs too much. Well, this is the cost of computer education as it goes down, and non-traditional education. If you go strictly non-traditional, the costs go down significantly, but the quality is not too good. Special education courses are up here already. The line's already crossed. Right now, if you want a tutor to tutor a child with dyslexia, it costs us about $20 an hour. You can get that same service for around $8 an hour, and it probably does twice as much in that hour, so it's really a $4 to a $20 ratio. In my experience, that's what I felt. The cost of elementary education is somewhere down around the $2, $1.50 to $2, and rising rather rapidly. And we project, if everything goes well, and that line has been plotted for a long time and is moving faster than we thought it would, it'll be down and competitive in around 78 or 79. But we're not targeting elementary and secondary education today. We're waiting until about 1980 or 79 when the crisis is reached, the crack in the system, and then I think these things will be adopted. We're setting these things up in industry and business and government in the United States, and then in elementary, secondary, and colleges overseas, and in colleges in the United States. There's quite a bit of interest. We have one large system in the United States at the University of Illinois. There's another one at FSU, Florida State University. The University of Quebec just purchased a system. And let me see, where else do we have? Well, there's interest in many, many places around the country. 60 plus universities have these systems operating off of either the Illinois system or ours. Quite a few high schools. All over the world. I just discovered 3 days ago that there's a group in the Royal Academy of Science in Sweden that has 4 of these terminals. And there's a guy there that's just so turned on about this that he has 4 of them there hooked via satellite to the University of Illinois computer. And he's been using them for several years. And he's doing some fantastic things in Swedish in terms of engineering kinds of things throughout Europe. We're setting our first system up in Europe this fall. We'll have it up running in January. And then I'm going to have a whole series of learning centers throughout Europe for management employees, and then they will grow to be outside kinds of things. We have, our company has 25 learning centers in the United States now, over half of them aimed at business and industry and the general public. We'll have 50 by this time next year, maybe 75. And so we're setting up a system outside of the traditional system. And that's what the Carnegie Commission said was going to happen. And this is what the National Science Foundation said too. It has to happen that way. And it's probably a good thing because other people are going to go in competition with us. And so we're going to, in order for us to survive in the marketplace, we're going to have to provide things to people that they're going to like belly dancing, like someone said yesterday. And I said, we already do provide belly dancing. So it's not all computer, although I think you could teach belly dancing on the computer because it's probably ideally suited to show you the techniques. Take somebody else to judge how well you're doing, but you could see an example of the various movements that it takes to do that. And so... It's not the subject matter is more important, I think, to me right now. That's my business. Than is the delivery method, because if we deliver things and people don't receive them, it doesn't do us any good. So I'm really more concerned about what people want. And the area that's the hottest in the United States right now is developing your own personal self-enhancement stuff in your leisure time. Parenting, the thing that Ann teaches, is going to be one of the biggest courses we have. That's more of a survival skill than a self-enhancement skill, though I'm convinced after listening to some of those sessions, it's more getting together to try to figure out how we're going to defend ourselves. But But there's a lot and a lot of interest in things like that. And I think I mentioned microwave cooking for men is the second largest seller that we have in the two or three centers we have like that. And it's meeting the need of the public. And there'll be competition. Somebody else is going to come in with another system like ours, and then we're going to begin to compete to see which is the best. And the public will decide whether or not they want it by whether or not they're going to pay for that. And that's today. Now, that's part of the problem, though. The future has to do something else for us to make everything available in small, even the small groups that want it but can't afford it. That was the hope of cable TV or closed circuit TV, and it didn't happen because there wasn't enough mass, and the communications problems were terrible. But now, large worldwide education distribution systems, more than one, are going to develop. We're setting up one. I think it's the first one. There'll be others. They're going to find that this is a huge business because the education business in the world is something like we were talking about the other day. I don't know for sure, but it's a $200 to $300 billion market. That's going to lure some people in. It's a very tricky business because most everybody that's gone into it out of business has failed miserably, and so you have to do it very carefully. But it's coming. It also requires the coordination, and I don't have this down here, but the thing that's got to happen, because it is so risky and so expensive, it's going to have to result in consortiums of government, private enterprise, individual citizens. I can't develop one piece of courseware because the cheapest one I can develop costs me $500,000. I can't do that myself. I don't have that much money. So I have to get someone like a couple universities and a government agency to do the kinds of things that have to be done. That's the tough part. The front-end costs are very expensive. Interactive, random access, instantaneous stuff. We have that already. We have to maintain that. That seems to be very important. It doesn't have to be 0.2 seconds, but it has to be relatively rapid. Larger memories are being developed and smaller units of memory. There are, by 1980, 85, I guess, the memories that are now big boxes are going to be this size, and you might be able to have them in your home, which you probably will. Video discs is something that I've been looking at for the last year. Did a study on it about a year ago and have been following it. I think that's going to be the next big jump. If you could get a stack of video disc records, everybody know what video discs are? It's like a phonograph record, except it plays back on a TV screen, sound and sight. If you could get a stack of these things and apply technology we already have, say that there were 50,000 frames in there, and you were going through something and you wanted one of those, we have the technology to find that within less than a second and can put it out for you in a still frame or a moving picture. And so when you combine all that, you get the sight, the sound, the whole thing. And just imagine what you could do as a teacher to pull all that together and stop and go on to the next thing, try something else out. Go read a book. It would be the next thing. Microwave and satellites, though, have to be developed because one of the very largest costs are the communications costs, line costs, except here in the state of Washington where you have a way of doing it cheaper than everywhere else, but it's very expensive. And I forget, I think it's like 40% of the costs of just generating things. Satellites are coming on strong. We just demonstrated our systems in Iran via satellite. It worked very well. I don't seem to have any trouble. I guess there is some trouble in getting lots of things going, and it does slow down the response time. The guy that invented all this at the University of Illinois says we're on the wrong planet. If the planet wasn't shaped this way and the satellites weren't in such and such an orbit, we'd be able to do things a lot faster with these systems. But I thought sometimes I wish he would, but no, he gives me a pretty bad time at times. No, he's figuring out some way of doing that. I'm not sure what it is. But microwave may be the solution. I don't know. I don't know much about that stuff. But then the things that are coming on are mini computers in the home, which you probably will all have in about a year. I was just reading an article, I have it here, in Business Week, these game types of things where you plug into your television set, you can get them for $70 now, you get a tic-tac-toe, you can doodle on the screen, and you can play a couple other games. And those are all little microprocessing chips that are computers for playing games. Well, you can. I mean, they've got them. And people are just going bananas. They're buying this stuff left and right. One of the hottest selling items out there in the world, Mary, is a microwave oven that has a very accurate self-timing mechanism, and that will do all kinds of things. That will thaw it out, do something else, do this, do that, do that. Oh, you have leisure time. Well, then you go study something. Well, you don't have to. Right. That's right. Well, I don't know. That's your own thing. Well, you're getting into some. There's some tremendous social problems that are going to come out of all this. Maybe we should get into next week. I'd like to talk about that because there's some social problems you brought up that I'm really concerned about. I kind of put them off yesterday because I want to talk about something else, but they're terrible. The biggest problem that I'm most scared of right now is whoever gets control over these huge communications. If this conference I went to for 3 days, and these were representatives of all kinds of things from all over the world, there were about 450 people involved. That's the biggest thing they were afraid of, that the government would take over these communication system, and that's power. Communication is power, not money, but communications. And the knowledge communications business is going to be the biggest business, and it's going to be the revolution in the next 20 years. Not education, I think it's the knowledge business is going to be the... That's right, something else. Something else, right. But the thing I really want to talk about next week, if I can do some homework, is this whole business that I learned at this National Science Foundation conference. And it raised about 15 different very, very serious issues that I had not really even thought much about. It also talked about all the things that could happen and how well they could be used. So the thing I keep walking into is that if we can stick our heads in the sands and ignore all this stuff and let it overwhelm us, because it is going to come, somebody else will do it and the government might take it over. The issue of freedom was the biggest issue, and the people from the government were the people that were the advocates of not letting the government have it because they've screwed up everything else. So that really made me happy. They said, we've got to get it out into four or five competing systems somehow, new kinds of systems that we don't have yet, and let the people have their choice. One idea, I was talking to the Commissioner of Education from Alaska at a recent meeting of all the commissioners. And I got into a discussion that led me to this kind of an idea, and I think it's technically possible. There's a new corporation, it's a satellite corporation, that will allow very cheaply people that have closed circuit TV systems in any city to communicate with each other. So if you have a system in Atlanta and you're running a course on some relatively obscure thing, maybe Greek, I don't know, that's not too obscure, but you know, something. But you want to teach a course in Greek from Holden Village or something, and you're teaching it here, and somebody in San Francisco who's on a closed circuit thing wants to plug into your course. Because of this satellite interaction, they will be able to do that. And you may have 15 people total throughout the United States taking that all in a different city, possibly at a different time. Because there's a new concept coming in where you can be speaking into a computer, and it will record you in such a way that when someone turns it on an hour later, they're talking to you. Okay, then they can talk back to you. You can plug in an hour later, and you can carry on a continuous conversation and never do it at the same point in time. Yes, they think it will be, yes. I've done some of this myself today. You can do it on this system where I want to ask you a question. You're not around. I'll leave you a private note. You look at the note, and you say, okay, I know the answer to that. So you write it down. I come back. It's not a face-to-face conversation, but it works surprisingly well in solving problems. I'm just amazed because it sounds kind of cold and crass, but in fact it's kind of fun. I don't pay much attention to it because I found a note the other day from Christmas time. Some guy sent me a Christmas message. I opened up my mailbox in June and it said, "Happy Merry Christmas." And I've been wondering why he hadn't been talking to me lately. I don't look at my notes too well, but I got to learn how to use the system. I don't know how very well, but those kinds of things are exciting. And then I was thinking about the use of video discs. They're very expensive when you get a stack of them. You know, they maybe retail for 10, 12 bucks a piece, but you get 50 of them. Not everybody's going to have one in their home. Not that kind of stack. And that's the critical thing right now, until they figure out how to put video discs into a small little box of non-moving molecules. And all of a sudden I realized that if you had maybe 10 or 15 of these discs in a system that would serve San Francisco, you could figure out how many you'd have to have so that nobody would ask for the same thing at the same time on the average, like the telephone company does. That's how they operate. Yeah, it'd be like a library, so that you could ask for, you wouldn't have to buy a video disc set. There would maybe be 15 to serve a couple hundred people or a couple hundred thousand, don't know. And I think maybe we're beginning to overcome the problems of the costs of these kinds of systems very rapidly. And so that it won't be too long before you'll have a thing in your home that'll be like your television set. If you can combine the TV set and the telephone with a couple of these little microprocessing things, you got a lot of things going for you with a large central processor in the middle. I kind of see that all working together somehow through a satellite. so that you'd be able to access something very obscure, an obscure conversation. Like we were talking to Dale, if you're going through a session with him on some of his art things, you may want to stop in the center and go through the history of somebody else in art and wander around. Somebody here on the West Coast recently was conducting a conference on memories, and they suspect that they will get down to such a point where something the size of a pack of cigarettes will contain a very large number of courses that you might take. You take it down to the public library, plug it in for a quarter, you get it updated, you take it home, plug it into your machine, and you get hooked into some other kinds of things, and you can just have all sorts of things available to you in your home. If it's done right, and that's the real problem, if it's not done right, it's not going to happen, number one, because it's a relatively expensive thing to do. Although the interest is so large and growing by the moneyed people in this country, around the world, that it's going to happen, I think. I really see it happening. The people that are going to meet in Venezuela at this conference I'm going to have enough money to make it happen right there. They'll do it. And that's not even including the United States. That's outside the United States. It's a little bit like thermonuclear power. You know, are we going to use it right or are we going to use it wrong? Yeah, same thing. Do books? Oh, books will be very relevant yet. If that's still the cheapest way to store knowledge for a long time. I don't know. It depends on how cheap memories get. Page turning on a computer terminal is one of the worst things you can do. That's a no-no right now because it's so expensive. It's also very boring. You can't curl up in bed like I like to do when I read with a computer terminal. They haven't got them that small yet. I don't know. They're around for a long time. We've just set up a publishing company, and one of the major things that we're going to produce our books for a long, long time. In fact, 70% of my courses are still textual books.